Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Harvey's toll, a pardon for Sheriff Joe, Trump's Moscow tower plan, sanctuary cities, tax reform in North Korea, record rains from Harvey in Texas and beyond, epic flooding, and a long road ahead.
We have a new all-time record now for the contiguous United States for rainfall from a tropical system at 51.88 inches.
A presidential pardon for Joe Arpaio, the controversial Arizona sheriff who was found guilty of criminal contempt. Activist Viridiana Hernandez said she's angry.
What Trump did today was pardon racism, white supremacy, and okayed the terror that Arpaio caused.
And North Korea's launch of a missile over Japan's northern Hokkaido island set off sirens not heard in a long, long time. They're saying missile passing, missile passing. This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Nicole Stockdale of the Dallas Morning News, John Yang of PBS NewsHour, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Has Harvey hit you? How are you faring? And how should the country respond? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Dallas is Nicole Stockdale, Deputy Editorial Page Editor for the Dallas Morning News. Nicole, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And from Washington, John Yang is with us, White House correspondent for PBS NewsHour. John, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom. Always great to be with you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Nicole, and John.
You're just one voice of many. The Associated Press talking today with Lily Galindo, a resident in Dickinson, Texas, trying to return to homes, finding devastation. Many Texans with just these sentiments.
I'm honestly at a loss for words. I just know I have work to do, and I'm a single mom with three girls. So, you know, to see our life literally float away, in a sense, and just being drowned. I got to swallow it and keep going.
Swallow it and keep going. That's a big flood to swallow. Nicole Stockdale, what's just the sense of your Texas coastline today coming out of the worst of this flooding? Overwhelmed? Supported? Give us some sense of how Texans are feeling in the face of all this.
I think right now the general sense I get is that is one of resilience. You have stories just like we heard from her of people who are willing to just swallow it and do what they need to do to start to recover. And it's really remarkable to see, given so much loss in this area and things that we've never seen before in our lifetimes.
Have you begun to hear Texas officials and others talking about what the comeback is likely to look like? What kind of time period, what kind of depth of damage are we looking at here?
Well, it's massive. You're talking about nearly 30% of the nation's fourth largest city was underwater, completely underwater. And you have 100,000 homes in Texas and Louisiana that have been damaged or destroyed. More than 35,000 people are in shelters right now, which doesn't even account for the people who have found friends and family to stay with. So the effort to get people back in their homes even is incredible. Then you start to think about just what that means for people. There's a toxic sludge that remains, the chemicals, sewage, debris that you need to pour through and get cleaned up so that it's safe for people to inhabit these areas. Not to mention the fact that there are hundreds of thousands of people in the area who use private wells for their drinking water that could be contaminated. So you have that part of the cleanup to deal with. The federal aid is expected to be billions. Right now, they're talking about $6 billion is the initial funding that they'd like to get. But that's just the initial down payment on what will be a much larger package. It looks like, you know, estimates are that it will be more than the $120 billion in federal funding sought after Hurricane Katrina. Governor Greg Abbott in Texas has said that he expects it to be far in excess of $125 billion. So we're talking huge numbers.
Wow. Here's Energy Secretary, former Texas Governor Rick Perry, yesterday saying that the Harvey recovery will be a rougher path than other previous natural disasters.
This is just going to take longer. It's going to be more difficult than any flood, any hurricane, any event that we've had.
John Yang, you're watching from Washington. Is the Capitol prepared to step up with the kind of funding that it's going to take to help Texas, Houston, the coastline and beyond dry out and dig out from this damage?
I think that they are. That's going to take a long time, and Congress is coming back next week after their August recess. This really has changed the conversation in a lot of ways. They've got to come up with a budget and fund the government for the next year at the end of September. At the end of September, beginning of October. I think it's changing the conversation. They're talking about a big deal of relief. As Nicole said, the first down payment, about $5.5 billion, $5 billion for FEMA, $500 million for the Small Business Administration loan fund. It's also going to be interesting to see how this affects funding for the border wall that President Trump says he's willing to shut the government down.
What's the connection, John?
In order to get. Well, I mean, it's money for Texas. Part of that border wall we built along Texas, the Texas border. The question is what money is more urgent. Money to recover from Harvey, or money to a down payment on start building the wall?
A question right there. And, of course, that became controversial this week as Mexico and the Trump administration exchanged barbs again, even in the midst of all this. We had the president who came down, others at this point, the vice president. We heard Rick Perry there and more. This was Tuesday in Corpus Christi, near where Hurricane, at that point, Harvey had made landfall. President Trump urging state and federal officials to make the response to this storm, he said, a model for future administrations.
We want to do it better than ever before. We want to be looked at in 5 years and 10 years from now. This is the way to do it.
This is the way to do it. Nicole, you're watching there from Dallas. What about FEMA, its performance, the coordination of efforts to anticipate and respond to this epic, record-setting rainfall?
Well, I would say when Trump visited Corpus Christi in Austin, Texas, we heard a lot of criticism nationally for everything from where he visited to the stilettos that his wife was wearing on the plane. And there was criticism also from, you know, some of the comments that he made in his speech and the tweets that he sent out about, turning it into a rally and talking about the crowd size. But when you look at what residents in Houston and elsewhere in Southeast Texas, I didn't hear a lot of criticism coming from them. They have their heads down and they're trying to survive and recover. That seemed to be more criticism coming from talking heads and people who are apt to criticize anyway.
But what about the actual performance of emergency services on the ground? In Katrina, this became a huge story because they were deemed woefully inadequate. What about in the case of Harvey?
Well, I think you can make the argument that all of that was just optics, that in the fundamentals, things are going well. The administration really wanted to prove that this is not Katrina, and it has not been that at all. FEMA, in my opinion, has seemed organized and responsive. You've had local efforts from Houston city officials and county officials that have done the best they can with just truly historically catastrophic issues that they're facing. I'd say so far from my vantage point, things look like they are going about as well as could be considered.
Jack Beatty, this has been a very, very sobering week, not only for Texans and Louisianans, and now this moving north, Tennessee, Nashville, some flooding reported, but for the whole country, looking at the extent of damage here, and we all know the story of climate change going on in the background here, the warming of oceans that leads to heavier rainfall, and lots of coastal cities looking at this and thinking, what does this century hold for us?
Yes, James Hansen, we've had him on our program, the environmental scientist, has said that, you know, we should be chary of what he calls scientific reticence. That is, saying, well, we can't link climate change to discrete weather events. Well, that's true, but the point Hansen's trying to make is let's not parse this. Obviously, when the winter temperature of the Gulf of Mexico, I read, last year was 73 degrees. Something is happening. That body of water, all bodies of water, are heating up, and that is creating moisture in the climate and so on. And, you know, this is the third 500-year flood in Houston in 3 years. And in the face of it, one is glad to hear that the Trump FEMA is responding well. But, you know, the Trump Department of Agriculture has put out a memo saying, please, let's not refer to climate change. Call it weather extremes. Mr. Pruitt, the head of the EPA today, criticizes reporters for mentioning climate change. He says that's opportunism and it's misplaced. Well, it's not misplaced. It's the context of this. It's the global ecological context. And, you know, you say, what would be a proper response? Well, the one that Milton Friedman talked about decades ago, a carbon neutral, a tax on carbon that would be deficit neutral, would be a response tantamount to this unprecedented crisis.
Nicole, it's early. People are still wet and struggling, but you're there in oil country. Is Texas willing to entertain the climate change challenge at the same time it looks at the damage of Harvey?
Well, it's hard to speak about Texas as a monolith. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There are plenty of people in Texas who believe that the effects of man-made climate change are real and need to be mitigated. But there are probably just as many who say that although climate change is happening, that doesn't mean we need to take drastic measures to try to change it, because this is the natural weather patterns and there's not much that man can do to affect those.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you everything you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste, and it's delivered right to your door. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying seasonally inspired recipes and exploring new flavors and cuisines. No commitment. Get the meals only when you want. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/OP.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Emergency crews there, the sound of them in high water trucks and airboats maneuvering through neighborhoods in Houston to rescue desperate people there this week. And, of course, the damage far beyond Houston as well from Harvey. We're looking at epic rains, flooding, and Harvey. A pardon for Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio. President Trump's Moscow Tower plan back in the campaign days. Sanctuary cities, tax reform, North Korea firing a missile over Japan. Nicole Stockdale is with us, deputy editorial page editor at the Dallas Morning News. John Yang is here, White House correspondent for PBS NewsHour. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us as well. Are you packing relief supplies for Harvey? Is this the future? Rising, warming seas and trouble. How should we respond? And what do you think of President Trump's pardon of Joe Arpaio? Was it a signal to remind others of the president's power to pardon? Texans, where do you stand now on sanctuary cities? Where do you simply stand in this flood? Nathan is calling from Texas, Austin, Texas. Hi, Nathan. You're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. So I spent yesterday driving from Austin to Port Aransas. A couple things here. People are focused on Houston as they should be. I mean, Houston is just devastated. But we can't forget that there are towns and counties all up and down the coast that need help. Port Aransas is uninhabitable. No power, though they should have it back to the island by the middle of next week. They just got the water on, but there's no services. You can't eat, you can't drink the water, you can't you have to be very careful driving around because of debris will shred your tires and there's no shops available to fix anything. People are just there basically dumping first floor contents out in the street.
Yeah.
Second thing is about this gas deal that's going on in Texas right now. People need to chill out. I left at 7:30 yesterday morning and had absolutely no problem getting gas.
And oh, you mean people are panicking about getting just filling up their tanks? Is that what you mean, Nathan?
I drove back 4 hours. It's a four-hour trip. I stopped about halfway, and there were lines an hour deep along I-37 east of San Antonio. And I thought, oh, this is just a fluke. I'll keep going. Mm-hmm. And I stopped three more times along I-37 and the same thing. By the time I got to San Antonio, about a third of the gas stations along I-35 north in San Antonio were without gas. And the ones that had gas had lines 20, 30 deep backed up onto the access road. Thankfully, I drive a Prius, so I was able to get home. Austin, every gas station I stopped at in and around central Austin had bags over the pump handles.
Why? Why? They just don't have gas coming in? They don't have fresh supplies?
Well, the refineries are shut down.
Yeah.
Get it in their collective mob mentality that, oh, my God, there's going to be a gas shortage. Facebook starts spreading it. Social media starts spreading this idea that there's a gas shortage. So now everybody has to go out and fill up whether they need to or not. And we're creating a gas shortage because we think there's a gas shortage.
Nathan, we're glad you made it, and we're glad for your report. Let me take that, if I may, to Nicole Stockdale. I mean, Nicole, we don't want to in any way brush by the ongoing crisis that a lot of people are still facing right now in those, especially now in those towns over toward Louisiana, Port Arthur and Beaumont and more. What about the extent of the ongoing crisis as we speak at this week's end, Nicole?
Well, I think the gas shortage that you're seeing goes much beyond where the damaged areas are, and to all extents and purposes, we think that's being caused by, you know, local panic, and there isn't really a shortage of supply. People are mm-hmm. just all going up to fill up at once. But we're seeing that in Dallas as well. So it's widespread in Texas, but the officials believe that that should, you know, as people start to even out in their gas consumption, those shortages will even out as well.
What about direct effects of the storm, the lack of drinking water in a number of places, access to food and supplies and necessities for those who have been flooded out?
I think that gets at the real heart of the matter, at how long this recovery is going to take. You have Beaumont, which has both of its water pumps are underwater, and therefore the city has no water service. It can't tell you how long it will be until that water is turned on, until the water recedes, and they are able to look at what it will take to fix those pumps. And that's just one story mm-hmm. out of hundreds of how these towns are dealing with the destruction. And as the caller pointed out, you have varying degrees of destruction. You have places like Rockport and Port Aransas that are dealing with the actual hurricane and the water surge that came on, and, you know, 130 mile per hour winds that destroyed those towns. Then you have the massive flooding and rainfall that happened in points southeast of there. So there are a lot of different types of recovery that need to happen as well. And it stretches all along the Gulf Coast there. It's just really mind-boggling.
Nicole, what about the damage to the petroleum industry infrastructure there and more? How much is down? What are you hearing about how long it may take to bring it back up? Will the rest of the nation feel this?
Well, I think it's inevitable that the rest of the nation will feel it to some extent. We're looking at the refineries being down, and, you know, even though I think Rick Perry announced yesterday that they were going to release some of the nation's oil reserves, you still need to have the refineries to put them in. So that has trickle-down effects that we will be feeling for some time, not just the gas that you put in your vehicles, but also, you know, production of plastics and, you know, any number of petroleum, including products that come out of the Houston area. So this is not something that will be handled in a matter of weeks. It will take much longer than that.
And health effects for those in the flooded areas from contaminated water, from pollution in those waters, and potentially waterborne diseases, what's anticipated?
The EPA and other environmental groups are sounding alarms on what to look for. I mentioned one problem is the runoff from chemical plants and factories that is in the water. You have the drinking wells that so many residents down here use that are likely contaminated, that give you a real risk of waterborne diseases that could spread. We don't usually see epidemics, but you certainly need to watch out for those signs to see what might happen. There are short-term and long-term effects, depending on how long you are in the water and exposed to whatever toxic sludge happens to be in there. The amount of cleanup that comes in just from water being in your home, even if that water wasn't severely contaminated, mm-hmm. you have problems with mold that you need to deal with. So there are a lot, and some of that is very Houston specific, given the industry that is there along the coast.
I mean, we know the mold and all that, those problems that New Orleans faced in such a depth after Katrina. Rose in Miami, Florida. Rose, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, so I was calling in because I wanted to, I really wanted to thank one of our good friends out of Houston. I'm in Miami, and my parents live in the area that was affected. And they were trying to kind of wait it out. And so my only way of contacting them is whenever they would turn on their cell phone because they didn't have electricity.
Yeah.
So through Facebook, I tried to get information about the area, and as I had the information coming in, I quickly tried to organize someone to go out there to rescue them.
Are they okay? Were they rescued, Rose?
They were okay, yes. And our good friend Hemi Parvizian from Houston was able to get in his boat and went and rescued them. And I was so grateful because since then the waters have risen even more, and it would have been terrifying to not have any contact with them. So
Facebook, yes, we're glad to hear it. Facebook, mobile phones, and friends. Thank heavens for all of those in a crisis. I appreciate your call, Rose. Catherine in Cleveland. Thanks for calling, Catherine. You're on.
Hi, Tom. I was just calling. I was born and raised in Beaumont, and all of my family still lives there. And I wanted to address a couple of things. One, in Beaumont, they're still without water, and there's not much access to get out of the city. That's one of the biggest concerns, is even as of yesterday afternoon, only trucks were making it out on I-90, which is, you know, a small highway there. And second of all, I have lots of friends who have been displaced, lost everything in Houston, and they said that there's an influx of too many people sending like old clothes. And it's, I know being up in Cleveland, it's our instinct of how can we help? What can we send? And in this case, it's more important to send things like diapers or formula or even making monetary donations to some of the many causes there, because sometimes that, you know, used clothing and toiletries causes more harm than good.
Catherine, we've got it. Good intentions. But good advice on what people really need there, and I appreciate your call. John Yang, you're listening from Washington to the depth and extent of this destruction and the cleanup likely to follow. I mean, we touched on what's coming and what the needs are likely to be. Is there goodwill toward Texas here? We've seen this kind of crazy spat this week between Senator Ted Cruz out of Texas and Chris Christie. Ted Cruz, who had been critical when it came time to help New York after Sandy. And that became an issue this week between him and Chris Christie. Is there goodwill in Congress to lay down the very large amount of money that's going to be required?
I think so. I think you're not. I don't think you're going to be immune to that sort of political spat, that sort of reminding the Texas delegation, the Republicans in the Texas delegation, of their opposition to money for Hurricane Sandy relief. I think you're going to hear that. You're even hearing that not just from Chris Christie, but Peter King, Republican of New York, reminding some of his Texas colleagues. I think you will see them, and they have said that they are going to vote for money for Hurricane Harvey, but they're not going to be above reminding and tweaking their colleagues a little bit, reminding them of their positions before.
It was a pretty tough tweaking that Ted Cruz did back in Sandy times, and now the need is great in Texas. We're happy for your observations and your reports on what you're seeing from Harvey and its aftermath, whether in Texas or Louisiana or on up the Mississippi Valley. But there was more news this week as well. Even as the president and all of us saw Harvey coming, there was the news of his pardon of Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who has a very long history in Arizona, being very tough on the immigrant community there. Here was Arpaio after he received the presidential pardon, talking about his attitude toward President Trump.
I love that president. He supports law enforcement, and I'm very humble. If you recall, 2 years ago, I supported him, and I said publicly recently, pardon or no pardon, I will be with him to the end.
John Yang in Washington, what about the ramifications of the president's pardon of this man at this time? I mean, the record that people criticized him on and the courts went after him on was a long one. It went to core constitutional guarantees. The president said, no, you know, this is my guy. And in the aftermath of this, John, there was a large number of people saying, what on earth is going on here? But the president's standing tough and Arpaio grateful for it. How do you see the message of this playing out?
You've raised all the right points there, Tom. I think that it is significant. This is a man who was convicted not of breaking a law, but of disobeying a judge's order to enforce the Constitution, enforce constitutional rights for Latinos in Maricopa County. He was specifically said that he was told to stop detaining people solely for the suspicion that they were in the country illegally. This he did not go through. The president did not follow the guidelines of the Justice Department, didn't go through the regular pardon process. The Justice Department guidelines say that this is forgiveness. It's not a question of guilt, that guilt should be assumed in a pardon, and that one of the guidelines is seeing how the pardon petitioner, the person asking for the pardon, has behaved, whether they show remorse. And certainly Sheriff Joe has not shown any remorse. He's defiant. He still believes he did nothing wrong.
Let's go to Silas in Morehead City, North Carolina. Silas, you're on the air.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I want to follow up on that. You know, Sheriff Arpaio is supposedly a hero of law enforcement, which is, he speaks for certain American values in that respect. And, of course, the other side of the argument is that he's very much against American values in that he picks on minorities. But the real issue here is law enforcement. A judge's order ordered him not to do something. He did it anyway. And then the president steps in and pardons him. The contempt power, which was levied against Arpaio, is the only power that courts have to enforce their orders. What the pardon says is we have no respect for the only power that courts have for enforcement. It's totally anti-law enforcement. Forget about what you think about Joe Arpaio. The real significance of that pardon is that it completely undermined a judicial decision.
Silas, the feeling of the president's pardon, though, is that we had an illegal immigration crisis and this guy stood up to it, come hell or high water, and boy, I'm with him on that.
Well, then you appeal the contempt order, you go to your appellate judicial system, you use the systems that are in place in our democracy, which is the greatest value we have. And the trouble is it translates into other areas where you should be using the system. And I think of the Confederate monument issue where you have violence, which of course is lawless. Then you have students in North Carolina tearing down a Confederate monument, which was equally lawless. And both of these sides think they can take the law into their own hands because they have no respect for the systems in place to decide these issues.
Silas, we've got it right there, and our time is short before the break. I appreciate your call very much. Jack Beatty, how do you read the signal or signals in this pardon?
Well, there was one obvious signal to the, you might say, the baser reaches of Mr. Trump's base, the people who can identify with what Sheriff Arpaio did. But the other signal, I think, was directly to Paul Manafort and perhaps others, basically saying, if you don't flip against me, that is, if you don't tell if you know anything.
Paul Manafort, who Robert Mueller is looking into
That's right.
On the Russia front.
I've got a pardon for you. Well, of course, Mueller, as we learned from Politico this week, had a trump for that, which was he's now in league with the Attorney General of New York, such that if Manafort, who looks, there's some evidence or some suggestive evidence that he may have been guilty of money laundering, if Manafort is caught up in that, faces that charge, Trump can pardon him at the federal level, but not at the state level. So that Trump's been, as Larry Tribe said, he's been playing checkers and Mueller is playing four-dimensional chess.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, as Houston flooded under the downpour of Harvey, Houstonian Jim McInvale, known as Mattress Mac, turned his furniture stores into temporary shelters.
I got to be true to myself. Myself is about taking care of the community and doing what I can in my own little way to help these people realize that there's a light at the end of the tunnel.
A lot of people doing what they could in their own way. Lieutenant Greg Abbott, Cobb County, Georgia police officer, will lose his job after video surfaced of him trying to convince a white woman she had nothing to worry about during a traffic stop because she was not black.
I just don't want to put my hands down. I'm really sorry.
Not black. Remember, we only kill black people. Yeah, we only kill black people, right? All the videos you've seen, have you seen black people get killed? Yeah.
Good Lord, we only kill black people. He's fired. In a much-hyped fight, expected to break pay-per-view records, Floyd Mayweather Jr. defeated Conor McGregor by technical knockout in the 10th round.
Floyd Mayweather has McGregor on the run. A sharp left hook, another hook, and it's over. Robert Berg says it's over.
We are looking at a week in the news, Harvey and all of its ramifications, a pardon for Joe Arpaio, Trump's Moscow Tower plan back in campaign days, sanctuary cities, tax reform, North Korea firing that missile over Japan. John Yang is with us from the PBS NewsHour, Nicole Stockdale from the Dallas Morning News, Jack Beatty is here. John, can you take us to the news that came out this week about the Moscow Trump Tower proposal that was in play during the presidential campaign? What are the parameters of that conversation, and what how does it factor in, if it factors in, to the whole picture of Robert Mueller's investigation?
Well, it was an email from from someone in the Trump organization to Vladimir Putin's spokesman, asking for help in trying to get approval for a deal to build a Trump Tower in Moscow. It was during the campaign. And I think that the significance of this is that it flies in the face of the president's denials that he had anything to do with Moscow, that he was doing any business with Moscow, that he had loans from Russia during the campaign. And also, it's just one more contact between someone in the Trump organization or in the campaign and Russia. This sort of constant drip, drip, drip. As a reporter, I always get suspicious. If there's nothing wrong with what's going on, why not just tell us everything about it? Just come clean instead of having these little bits and pieces, drip and dribble out. How does this fit into the Mueller inquiry? It's not quite clear from the face of it whether there is any connection with a possible collusion in Russian interference in the election. But it's certainly one more reason for suspicion and to ask questions.
And somewhere along the way in there, John, there was this email saying, talking about Donald Trump saying, hey, we can get this guy elected president, buddy. Do you recall that?
We can get our guy elected president. That this would be that if he was able to show what a great deal maker he was by getting this deal to build the Moscow Trump Tower, that they felt I can't remember they felt that this would help elect him president.
Our boy can become president of the USA, and we can engineer it. I will get all of Putin's team to buy in on this. I will manage this process. Their email traffic lasts a long, long time. Listeners still thinking about Texas, and we know it. Here, Wynn says, swallow and keep going is the grit that ordinary Americans have in the face of such disasters. Amen. Gregor says, though, terrible week for Texas. Louisiana, that's going to hurt for a long time and change some things forever. $100 billion plus to pay the impacts of one storm. That is mind-blowing and unsustainable. That is always the backdrop of our conversation in this hour, Jack. But this Moscow Trump Tower deal, once again, putting the Russia story in front of Americans and investigators this week, Jack.
Indeed. And, you know, I was startled to hear Michael Beschloss, the presidential historian, make the following comparison. It's 1936. Franklin Roosevelt's running for president again. And while he's running for president, he's trying to do a business deal with Nazi Germany, which wasn't an enemy of the country then, right? Imagining such a scenario. Now, if that had come out, first of all, it would have given some background and perhaps even illuminated why Mr. Trump, contrary to decades of Republican rhetoric and principle, was saying such great things about Vladimir Putin. It would make him seem self-interested indeed there. And second, I find it very hard to believe that voters, even voters who wanted to send a message, they were fed up, could have stomached that if they had known it. In other words, I think it would have been a severe, if not fatal, blow to his candidacy.
Nicole Stockdale there in Dallas, does the investigation and these continuing stories out of Russia, do they have legs in Dallas? Are people focused on this, or the Trump administration is saying enough of that already? Let's be done with that.
Well, I think it's hard for people in Texas to focus on too much beyond what's going on here in Texas. Just there's been so much Texas news this week. But, you know, in any other week, would it have resonated? I think, yeah, I think people are interested in what, you know, what's behind all this smoke. Are they starting to find fire? And for people who pay close attention to what is going on in the Trump administration, here's one more piece of evidence that they haven't come clean.
Fascinating hints this week of distancing. I'm not sure what to call it. Inside the Trump cabinet, of cabinet members, perhaps from the president, there was this moment. Last week, the UN issued a warning to the U.S. saying that its leaders had not sufficiently condemned racism and hate crimes throughout the country, like that scene in Charlottesville, Virginia. And then talking with Chris Wallace, this was on Fox News Sunday, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson seemed to describe a distinction between American values and the president's when Chris Wallace on Fox pressed him on this.
I don't believe anyone doubts the American people's values or the commitment of the American government or the government's agencies to advancing those values and defending those values.
And the president's values?
The president speaks for himself, Chris.
The president speaks for himself on American values. We tried to take on board exactly what that might mean. And then there was this video and tape that came out of Secretary of Defense James Mattis in the Middle East last week, but the tape got attention this week. And he's talking with American soldiers out on the front lines and talking about the problems at home, asking them, soldiers, just hold the line, we'll get our act together back at home. Just interesting to hear. Here was Mattis with U.S. troops on the front lines.
You're a great example for our country right now. It's got some problems. You know it, and I know it. It's got problems that we don't have in the military. And you just hold the line, my fine young soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines. You just hold the line until our country gets back to understanding and respecting each other and showing it.
John Yang, both of those very interesting. The president speaks for himself from Rex Tillerson, and the Secretary of Defense out in the field having to tell soldiers, look, we got problems at home, but you hold the line. And he didn't seem to mean just militarily, but on values. You hold that line out here while we try and get our act together at home. Both of these turning heads in the last week, John.
And you also see Secretary Mattis sort of talking about holding the line in a way against the president and in a couple of other ways. After the president tweeted earlier this week that talking to North Korea didn't make any sense, he was asked at an event later that morning, Secretary Mattis was, whether that meant diplomacy was done. And he said, no, diplomacy is never done. There's always room for diplomacy. On the transgender ban in the military, the Secretary Mattis sort of tapped the brakes on that. The president in his original tweet said that transgender people would not be allowed to serve in the military in any capacity. Secretary Mattis said, well, let's hold off on that. Let's that those transgender troops currently serving would be allowed to continue to serve pending a review, a commission to look at the effects of all this. And the other notable one was Gary Cohn, the head of the National Economic Council, who gave an interview to the Financial Times in which he said that the president had to do better in talking about what happened in Charlottesville. Acknowledged that he didn't acknowledge in that interview, but it's known known that he had written a letter of resignation. And the president appears to be a little annoyed with Cohn. You know, the president gave a speech earlier this week in Springfield, Missouri, to talk about taxes. Mm-hmm. He introduced just about everybody who came with him from Washington except Gary Cohn.
Who had been expressing unease. On Wednesday, the president, indeed, on the Mattis front in North Korea, the president had tweeted Wednesday morning, talking is not the answer. And then that same day, you had the defense secretary saying that diplomatic solutions, still there. Here he was.
We're never out of diplomatic solutions. We continue to work together. And the minister and I share a responsibility to provide for the protection of our nations, our populations, and our interests.
U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis standing there alongside his South Korean counterpart. Jack Beatty, what do you see in these hints and murmurs and more?
Well, the president seems isolated within his own government. I mean, we've seen his isolation self-imposed, really, from his Republican colleagues in Congress. I mean, he's conducted... he's attacked Mitch McConnell and others for a good while. And now we see he's isolated even within his own cabinet, and they seem to be treating him a little bit like the uncle, the flatulent uncle who shows up for Thanksgiving, and you let him ramble on, and then you just ignore him, and that they're sort of embarrassed by this. And you know that word embarrassed. Peter Hart did a focus group this week in Pittsburgh. And Trump voters in the group, and they were still with Trump. That's important to point out. But the dominant word they used and others was they were embarrassed by the president, by things he says, by his tweets, by the kinds of things that the secretaries were reacting to.
Well, I mean, maybe, but he's still got that base of support, and he's got this his staff around him in the White House that we've heard supporting him. And his agenda looking forward. Let's go to Charleston, South Carolina. Art, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question about the North Korean situation. My understanding is that the missile this past week was shot over Japan, and it entered Japan's airspace. I never heard any discussion about whether Japan or the U.S. considered shooting it down. I'm not suggesting that we escalate the matter, but what are the defense and international law aspects of that issue?
I'm glad you ask it. A little sound here first as we think about that. This was the Japanese Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, condemning that launch of the missile that flew over the northern island of Hokkaido. This was the Prime Minister on Tuesday.
The missile, which passed over our nation, represents the greatest and gravest threat to our nation ever. It also is an egregious threat to the peace and stability of the Asia-Pacific region.
Gravest threat ever. That's tall language in a country that has actually been at the receiving end of nuclear weapons in World War II, of course. John Yang, I mean, I had the same question that Art raised. You know, we've heard... We see North Korea continue forward on its nuclear, its missiles and its nuclear program. We hear about technology that can shoot these down, the Aegis system and others deployed in that region, and Japan bucking those up. But here one flies right over Japanese airspace, and it just flies over. What does that suggest, John?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know that that we know whether or not there was any discussion of trying to use the anti-missile defense systems. You know, but it also there's another question that's raised by that is if the United States does try to knock one of these missiles, these test fires out and fails, what does that say? What message does that send, and what are the implications of that?
This one, flying over Hokkaido, if it were flying toward Tokyo, I'm not sure what the answer might be. Another story this week, Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, reversing Obama-era restrictions on police departments acquiring U.S. military surplus equipment. That's, you know, grenade launchers and armored vehicles and bayonets and all the rest. How's that being interpreted, John? Why was that withdrawn in the first place, and how's the reintroduction of that flow being received?
Well, it fits in with the president's law and order theme, and also with Jeff Sessions' positions on police. He, I mean, he was a very critical of the consent decrees, that the agreements that local police and police agencies were entering into with the Obama Justice Department to change their practices. And it's also sort of a thank you. The Trump campaign got a lot of support from police unions, and so this is a thank you to them. But it's also interesting because it's getting a lot of it's getting some criticism also from Republicans. Rand Paul, sort of limited government Republican, Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, said that he objects to it. It's this continuation of what he calls the militarization of police forces. Representative Mark Stanford of South Carolina said he shakes his head at this. He says both as a taxpayer and someone interested in civil liberties. The other thing to note is that a lot of this equipment, a lot of the defensive equipment, Kevlar helmets, body armor, that sort of thing, was still available. You had to prove a need for it. What was prohibited were things like armored personnel vehicles, grenade launchers, 50 caliber and above rifles, things that the Pentagon acknowledges they don't quite understand why a local police force would want those things.
Jeff Sessions saying we will not allow criminal activity, violence, and lawlessness to become the new normal. Nicole Stockdale, do you have the sense of the country thinking that, you know, lawlessness and violence are the new normal?
Well, I think they don't think that until they hear it from their attorney general, who puts the idea in people's minds. These aren't the types of things that you see every day that your local law enforcement officers need to deal with. And to me, it seems largely a question of optics and not one that matters nearly as much when you're actually on the ground.
Well, optics until something happens. We remember in Ferguson, Missouri, when we suddenly saw lots of heavy equipment on the ground, and then it can be pretty eye-popping. Nicole Stockdale at the Dallas Morning News, our thoughts with your state right over toward the coast and on up into Louisiana and beyond. It's been a hellish week there, and we wish you all the very best in cleanup and recovery. We're very grateful to you for being with us today, Nicole. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
John Yang at PBS NewsHour, White House correspondent there. John, thank you as always for joining us. Great to have you today.
Great to be with you, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, thanks for joining us. Have a good weekend, Jack.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.